On the right, a liberal would be the prime minister. In fact, he's even been called a communist. And my name is John de Grouchy. I think it's helpful to begin with if I had to say that the word apartheid simply means separateness. It often is spelt in kind of anti-South African propaganda, A-P-A-R-T hyphen H-A-T-E, okay? Apartheid. That's to help Americans pronounce it. But there's also a subtle message being communicated in that spelling. But it is a Dutch Germanic word which refers to separateness. And that is important in understanding what apartheid is about. Because its basic meaning is derived from an understanding which sees every nation, every ethnic community as distinct and separate. So I want you to keep that in mind. I also want to make the observation which was made by one of the speakers at Vancouver at the World Council of Churches Assembly, the German theologian Dorothy Zoller, who commented that apartheid or the apartheid theology is something that is all pervasive. It is not just found in South Africa, but the more you reflect on what apartheid is in that context, the more you see how all-pervasive apartheid is. And that will become particularly important for us tomorrow when I'm going to talk a little bit about apartheid as a heresy. And in that connection, a little commercial may be not entirely out of place. Apartheid as a Heresy is the title of a book which I've just edited together with a colleague of mine in Cape Town. This is the South African and British edition. The American edition is being published by Erdmans, and they promised to have it out last month, so it should be out this year sometime. You may be interested in the essays in this book. There are essays by Alan Busack and Desmond Tutu, as well as an up-and-coming black Lutheran theologian, Simon Mayamela, and several others, and an article by Doug Bax, who I mentioned in passing yesterday, on the Bible and apartheid. And I'm going to come back to what he has to say a little later this morning. When you hear the word, or rather the name, South Africa, most people today throughout the world immediately associate that with apartheid. There's a kind of word association. South Africa equals apartheid, apartheid equals South Africa. And therefore, to focus on that word or that concept, that ideology, is really to unpack the whole social, political development of South Africa. It's a way of getting into what South Africa is all about. It is a word which perhaps more than any other, sums up racism as something institutionalized, not just as something that we all experience and encounter all over the place, but racism when it is institutionalized as a matter of public policy. And that's what we're talking about. The only equivalent, in fact, that I can think of, and it's not the same, is the caste system in India. In fact, some recent commentators on South Africa talk about racism in South Africa as a caste system. And you know that in the Indian caste system, there is a very rigid line drawn between the various castes. And while that line is determined by a whole bunch of things, ritual purity and so on, the fundamental fact is your birth. You're born into a caste. And unless you become an outcast, which means often becoming a Christian, unless you become an outcast, you're there. There's no mobility possible in terms of marriage and a whole bunch of other things. Well, that's another story which we needn't get into, but it is a good parallel example of apartheid. Now, I'm going to put up a transparency which right at the beginning says something about apartheid, and then I'm going to go back and start talking about the social history of South Africa to show how the policy originated, how it came into being. But let me just put this up so that we have a focus in the back of our minds, and it elaborates on what I just said. Apartheid or separate development. You see, I've talked about apartheid meaning separateness. So we're talking about separate development. That is how the National Party, the Afrikaner White National Party, the governing party in South Africa, understands its policies. They do not like to use the word apartheid, partly because it has a kind of sinister connotation, although originally it didn't have that. It simply meant separateness. Okay? I remember earlier this year at Princeton, in the faculty dining room, talking with a visiting professor from South Africa, an Afrikaans professor, and I was referring to the fact that we were discussing this topic, apartheid is a heresy, and he said, please don't use that word apartheid. So I said, why not? So he said, because we're talking about separate development. See, separate development is projected as something positive, as separateness, but with a human face. Apartheid is seen as something evil, and even the people who coined that phrase and used it politically earlier on this century, and we'll talk about that, now find it an embarrassing word to use. And my reply was, well, we didn't choose that word. You chose it. And if you had to say to any black person in South Africa, what is separate development all about, they'd say it's about apartheid. You see? But the official policy is not apartheid. The separate development is the title of the policy of the governing party. The theory is that each race is intended by God. Now that's important. Okay? Each race is intended by God. It's not just a pragmatic policy. It's not just something that the Democratic Convention could think of overnight and put into their platform. No. This has its roots in an understanding of ultimate things. It has a theological base, hence the appropriateness of talking about apartheid as a heresy, which we'll come back to tomorrow. Now, there we need to also be clear about more recent developments, because today the government is trying to project a non-ideological understanding of separate development, and they talk about it as a pragmatic policy without which there would be total chaos in the country. You need separate development to prevent violence.
Is there a hierarchy to the separate development of the races?
Yeah, sure, and I'll be coming to that. Thank you for raising that. As in the caste system, there is. And in the caste system, you know, it often is also determined by color. It's an interesting phenomenon. Not always. Each race is intended by God to remain and to develop separately. And you will also see that that raises a bunch of very difficult questions, because there are a lot of ethnic communities in North America, for example, who like to retain their separateness. Mennonites in Kansas, Norwegians in Wisconsin, or wherever, Pennsylvania Dutch, to mention just three, but the Hispanic communities and so on, who may well claim that God intends them to retain their culture and identity. And that's a reasonable kind of thing. So there's a reasonableness to this idea that perhaps God intended each ethnic community to retain its culture and to develop separately. And maybe one can find some justification for that in the Bible. In practice, what apartheid means is that legislation has been passed over the last, well, now 50 years, I'd say, at every level of life to keep the races separate in the fields of education, labor, residence, marriage, and separate homelands. The church, and again this is a theme we'll pick up, has refused, except for one or two notable exceptions, has refused to be forced into that pattern. So that there is, I think, in South Africa, a great deal more interracial, multiracial contact within the life of the church than I've experienced in North America. Although the theory of separate development is to allow each group to develop separately but equally, in practice, it means discrimination against blacks almost entirely. Right, well, that is some basic comment on apartheid. I'm going to now move into the historical development to show the origins of this particular ideology. But let me pause there for a moment in case someone has a question. Okay, well, nobody has a question. I find the easiest way to do this is to put a map up on the screen. Whoops, that's South Africa as viewed from Australia. Okay, we looked at the map of South Africa yesterday, and I won't go over that today. But let me now start to put some things on the map. This is the movement of people in South Africa before 1650, in other words, before white colonization. Now, yesterday I indicated that when the first Dutch settlers came to the Cape in 1652, they found indigenous people here, namely the Khoi and the Sam. We refer to them as Bushmen or Hottentots, but that, as I mentioned yesterday, is a derogatory title. Those groups we can just leave for the moment, but if there's any parallel, you might think of them in terms of the first Native Americans encountered by the Pilgrim Fathers and others on the East Coast here, because many of them died from smallpox, from skirmishes with the settlers, and they fled into the interior. They were hunters and herders. And today, you find them here. If you've read Lawrence van der Post's Lost Tribes of the Kalahari and all that, well, he talks about them up in Botswana and so on. But they inhabited this part of the Cape when the first white settlers came. But the black population that we normally refer to today as black South Africans migrated into South Africa in the centuries before 1650 and also after that period. And they are part of two major African groupings, the Nguni tribes and the Sotho. And they migrated down from Central Africa, and there are lots of links between the native peoples of South Africa and the rest of Central and Southern Africa. Some of the tribes settled. I should also point out something here that is important. The argument of Afrikaner nationalists traditionally has been that when the whites first arrived in South Africa, the country, with the exception of these small indigenous tribes down here, the country was unsettled. It was vacant. It was open territory for anybody who wanted to take it. And therefore, the traditional history books have pointed out, or rather claimed, that the black people arrived in South Africa around about the same time as the white people. and they met somewhere along here, and therefore the land is open to either group. Now the truth in that is that these black peoples certainly were not here originally. This was populated by these other groups, as I've mentioned. The untruth in that story is that they arrived at the same time. There were lots of black communities here when the white settlers came. I guess from about the 14th century onwards, the migration took place out of Central Africa into Southern Africa. And the tribes settled in various distinct regions. The Nguni people, the Zulu and the Xhosa, here in Natal and Transkei and Ciskei, and the Sotho people here in Free State, the Sotho, they have ties with the Tswana and Northern Sotho and so on. Now, I don't want to go into all that history or tell you the differences between the groupings. I just want you to see that within South Africa, you have at least five or six major tribal groups amongst the black people. And that's really the only point that I want to make, and that they migrated into South Africa. Are there any questions about that?
Do they all have their own language?
Yeah, each tribe has its own language, and there are also dialects within the tribal groupings. As I mentioned yesterday, in the church to which I belong, there are 10 different languages spoken.
In one church?
Yeah, one denomination. Yeah, sure. I think you've got problems. the Dutch East India Company sent out its officials here in 1652. This was followed by some French Huguenots, about 200 of them in 1687, and then by some German settlers shortly after. And that provided the basis for the emerging white Afrikaner community. Settlers here, farmers and so on, in these very lush regions around here, wine farms, wheat farms and so on, as I talked about a little yesterday. And gradually this community expanded along the east here, rather than this way, because going up here, although some went up here, they would have encountered a very arid territory. The Kalahari up there, but the Karoo and semi-arid, semi-desert areas. But along this coast, they discovered grazing land and good farming land. By 1785, there were towns all over here. Crawford is a particularly interesting one for other reasons, which I won't go into. But one of the things that this community required was labor for their huge farms. And we're not talking about smaller farms here, such as you find in the United States. We're talking about huge farms. Without combines and things. So they needed a lot of labor. Well, where do you get labor? They couldn't use the Khoi and the Sand peoples because they were hunters and herders and gatherers. They were nomads. They were just not going to settle, although some were conscripted into service. Well, where would Dutch people at that point in time get their slaves from but from the Dutch East Indies? And so the slaves were shipped in from Malaya, but also from Madagascar, an island to the east here. Most of them, however, came in from Malaya, and most of them were Muslim. So they were brought in and became the slaves of the white settler farmers here in the Western Cape. Now that's quite interesting and important because when we talk about blacks in South Africa, the tribes that we already referred to, they hadn't really been encountered yet. And they were never brought into the slavery system. Maybe isolated examples, of course, but that's not where the slave population came from. So you have a very different kind of thing to what happened in the United States, except that there is a parallel, because the black slaves were shipped from Africa to America, and the Indians were never slaves, Native Americans. Okay. So the parallel between the United States and South Africa in this regard is blacks equals Native Americans, and American blacks equals what are now called Cape Colored. In other words, a mixed race who were slaves who were brought in to work on the farms. from the, what you would call plantations. Now, we're beginning to see something of the ethnic pattern in South Africa. We can, at this point in time, distinguish between the white Dutch settlers, who, together with the Germans and the French Huguenots, gradually formed the Afrikaner community and developed the language called Afrikaans, which is very similar to Flemish. And Flemish, if you know about it, was also produced out of that kind of interaction of European languages, French, German, and Dutch. If you speak Afrikaans, there's one place in Europe that you can go to and talk the language, and that's Belgium. Rather nice. You have some way to talk it. So we have the Afrikaner community, which emerges from the 17th century. We have the Cape Coloured community, made up of people brought in from the East, some of whom were Muslims, some of whom married white settlers, because there were very few women who came out to the Cape with the men. And gradually you had a coloured community emerging. Now, I'm using that word coloured in its technical sense. It's a pejorative word in most places, also in South Africa today, but it's difficult to find an alternative. So I'll talk about Cape coloured rather than just coloured people or some folksy word like that. And then you've got the black tribes up here gradually pushing their way down, interacting with each other to this eastern part here where Algoa Bay, where Port Elizabeth and East London are today, in Transkei and Ciskei. And eventually, at right about the middle and towards the end of the 18th century, these two groupings began to come into contact in a new way. But that doesn't complete the picture by any means, because, whoops. In events in Europe had a tremendous impact on what was happening in the European colonies, like South Africa. And of course, at this stage, there was no South Africa, there was a Cape Colony. South Africa is a later development. The British were beginning to defeat everybody that they could lay their hands on, and they defeated the Dutch, and therefore, automatically, Dutch controlled colonies came under British rule, not always, but generally. In 1806, the British got control of the Cape and occupied it. Some very interesting things happened as a result of the British occupation, particularly the second occupation, which was about 10 years later, because the official religion of South Africa, or of the Cape Colony, overnight became Anglican, or Church of England. But there were no Church of England people there, except some soldiers. So you have this interesting thing of the Dutch Reformed Church having been the state church, now no longer actually being the state church, although it had all the members. But the Church of the Governor was the Church of England. Well, they sorted that one out, and I might say something about that tomorrow if anybody's interested. However, after the Napoleonic Wars, when Britain was looking for places to send its unemployed, and please note how Europe solved some of its problems. It solved them a long way away from where the problem, in fact, should be solved. It sent a lot of convicts to Australia. That's how Australia got underway as a modern nation. Incidentally, the convicts all came to Cape Town originally, but the Cape Town citizens were too upright and they wouldn't have them. So Australia really has developed because Cape Town wouldn't have their convicts. That was a very interesting saga. But in 1820, the British sent out a lot of the unemployed and people who were uprooted as a result of the Napoleonic Wars, promising them a land of plenty and cheap labor and a bunch of other things. And they came out and settled here on this very beautiful but somewhat rugged coast. And they soon discovered why they were put there. They were put there because here were the Afrikaans settlers, and here were the black groups.
Oh.
And they were shoved in the middle. Okay, you guys sort this one out for us. You open up some farming land and so on, and see what you can do. So these guys who arrived in top hats and frock coats and everything else were dumped literally right there. I think there were a thousand or two of them. With very little farming experience, they came out of London and Southampton and Bristol and such places, found themselves there. And that was really the beginning of the English-speaking community in South Africa. Although there were some here, officials of the British colonial power. Natal was also colonized by the British in the 1850s, and that was another major input of English-speaking citizens. In fact, they say that Pietermaritzburg, the capital of Natal, is more British than the British. Something like Victoria on Vancouver Island, if you know that. Well, there were a whole bunch of wars here between the whites and the blacks, which began to shape perceptions of each other, important. Also, the British began to bring in a whole bunch of kind of liberal ideas that didn't go down well with the Dutch Afrikaans farmers, such as slaves should be set free. I mean, what a terrible thought. You've got this huge farm to farm, and you need slaves, and these British come along and tell you that they should all be set free. After all, they're black. So, British are crazy. So, what happened was that when the freedom of slaves took place in the 1830s, a whole group of Afrikaners began to trek, that's where the word comes from, began to trek into the interior. It was a kind of westward expansion, if you want to look for an equivalent in the United States. And as they moved into the interior, they began to occupy the land. And they believed that where land wasn't occupied by anybody else, it could be occupied by them. And there was plenty of land going. And generally, they lived in a kind of uneasy but relatively harmonious relationship with the various tribal groups that were also there. As I said, the land is vast and there's plenty of room for everybody. But gradually, tensions built up as in North America, people had different understandings of what land is all about and who owns it and what are grazing rights and who do cattle belong to, and so conflict situations developed. The trekkers kept on trekking all over the place, settling in the Transvaal, across the Vaal River, even into Mozambique, where most of them died from malaria, and down here into Natal, where they left when the British began to rule Natal. Such was the picture by the towards the end of the 19th century. And then, all of a sudden, diamonds were discovered here, and gold was discovered there. And that led to another major influx of people from Europe. This time they weren't the casualties of the Napoleonic Wars. This time they were prospectors and others who were out to make a fast buck, to get rich quick. Or they were, as my wife's family, they were Cornish miners who came out to, because they were redundant in Cornwall at this stage, they came out to work on the mines and to use their technical skills there. First diamonds and then gold. And almost overnight, South Africa was transformed from a pastoral farming nation into an industrial one. And there was not only this tremendous influx of Europeans into the Boer republics, the Afrikaner republics, these were now British colonies, but also the involvement of black labor on the mines. And that is a very important facet of the South African situation. Black labor and its integration into what was essentially a European style of building a country, technologically, economically, and so on. eventually, British interests in gold and diamonds, you'll notice that the British redrew the boundary of the Free State here. The Free State used to include the diamonds, but they redrew it on a map to exclude it and keep it in the Cape. But eventually a whole bunch of things led to a war between Britain and the Boer republics of the Transvaal and the Free State. It was much like the Civil War, except for the fact that the fighting was done by British soldiers brought into the country, not by English-speaking South Africans, by and large, although some of them were involved. It was the British army, with some Australians and New Zealanders and so on, fighting the Boers, who were, of course, by this time, part and parcel of the scenery in the Transvaal and the Free State. And that Anglo-Boer War, or what the Afrikaners call the Second War of Independence, lasted for 2 years, 1900 to 1902, or 1899 and 1901. Anyway, it was 2 years, round about then. And created tremendous bitterness between the English-speaking community and the Afrikaans-speaking community, the two white communities in the country. Now, what were they fighting over? Well, they were fighting over political power, who should rule here. They were fighting over economic issues, who should control the wealth of the country. They were fighting over the black issue. Should blacks be regarded as citizens? Okay, that was an issue. Although that really was more an excuse for fighting rather than a serious issue, because neither of the two parties were angels on that score. But the British made out that they were philanthropic in this regard, and that the Boers were bad for blacks. I guess the North-South conflict in the United States had something of that in. But one of the dimensions to that Anglo-Boer War was the development of concentration camps. The first concentration camps in modern history were developed by the British in South Africa. And many Boer women and children died in concentration camps in various parts of South Africa. And that is still a major psychological, historical issue, part of the psyche of the Afrikaner people. Many of the descendants of people who died in concentration camp are, of course, still alive. Well, that's an understatement. And that memory is very real. And I remember at Princeton last semester, where my wife got into a women's group that was discussing South Africa, and the speaker on that occasion was an Afrikaner woman, who presented a picture of South Africa as she perceived it, and then my wife came in with a few sort of gentle criticisms of what she had said. And this Afrikaner person got very upset and uptight and came out with a comment to somebody afterwards. My mother always told me that the English who put us in concentration camps would never be our friends. Now, that's part of the legacy that one is struggling with in South Africa. Not just a black-white thing, but a tension between Afrikaner and English. I discovered in a Mennonite college a library in Kansas a document which is had published in the Church Struggle in South Africa, in which this Dutch Mennonite pastor in Holland, speaking on behalf of the oppressed Afrikaner Boers, spoke with the most tremendous emotion on this concentration camp issue. And when you read that, you begin to understand why the Afrikaner sees himself or herself, or the Afrikaner people, as a God-created community with a specific culture, language, identity, placed there by God, having fought against Pharaoh, namely the King of England, or Queen Victoria, or whoever, having been led into the Promised Land, and then having encountered the Philistines. I mean, the whole thing is there. And how God has led us through persecution at the hand of the oppressor, and that if anybody has the claim to be the first liberated people on the African continent, it's us. Our liberation struggle predates all the other liberation struggles. And I'll be talking a little bit later in the week about the fact that much of the liberation theological terminology that is used by black theologians today is paralleled by what has been used by Afrikaner theologians in the past. Exodus, promised land, suffering, people, the whole lot. It's all there. It's all there. Well, out of the conflict between Boer and Britain was born the Union of South Africa. When the two British colonies of Natal and of the Cape were united with Transvaal and the Free State, Basutoland, or what is called Basutoland, Swaziland, opted to remain out of that, as did Bechuana and Angkor Botswana. But these four provinces came in to form the Union of South Africa in 1910. It was a compromise, because although the British had defeated the Boers were still by far the majority of the white population in South Africa, and still the most powerful group in many ways, although they did not have political power. And the compromise was this, that the Boer republics refused to come into the Union if the more liberal racial policies of the Cape were embodied in the constitution. And so the compromise was that you could have limited black enfranchisement in the Cape, qualified enfranchisement for blacks, but in the rest of the country, no. Only whites would have the vote. So already in 1910, the constitution of the country was based on race. Who had the vote was determined by race, except in some situations in the Cape. That was the constitution agreed to by Britain. It was formulated finally and approved in Westminster. And therefore, when you talk about the constitution in South Africa, it's a very different thing that you're talking about to when you appeal to the constitution in the United States. Because the United States has built into it the concept of equality, okay, constitutionally. In South Africa, the constitution from 1910, from the formation of the country, has built into it a racial distinctiveness, inequality. So when we talk about apartheid, we're not just talking about what was formulated by the Afrikaner nationalists when they came to power in 1948, when that word was coined, but something that is built into the whole historical development of the country. That it is God's will that the tribes and the peoples of South Africa should develop separately. The English, the Afrikaans, the blacks, the Cape Coloureds. Okay? There should be separate schools, not just for black and white, but for English and Afrikaans. Okay? And for colour. Well, let me pause there for a moment, maybe some questions, and then I'll begin to say more about what has happened more recently to bring the thing up to date. Any questions? By the way, am I going too fast? Is it reasonably clear? I'm simplifying a great deal. I'm sure that people with a knowledge of South African history would be horrified at some points about what I'm doing to history. Yeah.
Wondering if you had seen the movie Breaking Moran and
Felt
that was an adequate representation.
Oh, sure, yes. Breaking Moran, of course, it wasn't filmed in South Africa, but it was about South Africa. It was a very good movie. It was well reviewed in South Africa. And of course, it's an indictment on the British, not on the Boers.
In war.
So it's more popular with the Afrikaners than the English.
Well, today, that distinction, I mean, those of us who are English speaking don't have a great affinity with England. Generations have passed.
And yet, do you have a South African passport, or do you have an option for an English?
No, I don't have any option. I have a South African passport.
I see. Is that the majority of English speaking people?
Yeah.
I see. It's only people with.
Only people with a father who was born in England can have an English passport. And even that's becoming tricky, as the Falkland Islanders have discovered.
Question?
Yeah.
Why is it hard for South African blacks to get passports?
Can I hold it over? Are you going to be here later in the week? Just tomorrow. Well, let me answer it straight away. There may be two reasons. The one is that there may be politically involved in a way that the government wouldn't like them to be out of the country talking about South Africa. Okay. And the second is that the whole policy of separate development is denying South African citizenship to large sections of the population, so that they're no longer South African, but they're Transkeians, or they're Venda, or they're Maputixwanas, and I'll have to hold that until I get to talking about that.
What is your definition of the Boers and their relationship?
Boer is simply a Dutch word for farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's got a pejorative meaning today. It means oppressor for black people. I'm talking about die Boere. That,
uh-huh.
That's a pejorative expression, but it means farmers, and they were originally, and to many, in many ways, still a farming community.
Mm-hmm.
But it refers to the Afrikaans community.
Oh, the entire Afrikaans community?
Yeah, sure.
Of course. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Does that include the colored people?
No. Although most colors, majority of colors speak Afrikaans.
But it does include English?
Doesn't include English, no.
No.
I mean, you have English speaking farmers, but none of them would be Boers.
You made a distinction between the Afrikaners and the Cape colors.
Yeah.
And then the blacks as well. And do you, am I getting ahead of you at all as far as the mixed races? And the fact that you said that the slave labor was imported from and so then there's, and you just told me most of the colors speak African and blacks as well. That
no, the blacks don't speak Afrikaans.
Yeah, but so the blacks will speak a tribal language and then learn.
And English probably. Some would speak Afrikaans.
So,
yeah, I'll explain it on this thing. Yeah. I've left off here the same story. Because they're not a political reality in South Africa. The population is now a little more than 26 million, but let's work with that figure for the sake of this chart. The black African peoples divided into these major tribal groups. As I indicated, they arrived in South Africa from about the 14th century onwards. About 18.5 million, probably now nearing the 20 million. 71% of the population, probably now 73-74% of the population. Okay? Now, each of these speaks a different language. But English would be probably reasonably common amongst many of them, especially those urbanized. And some on farms would also speak, or would speak Afrikaans, but not necessarily English. The Cape Colored people, about 2.5 million, 10% of the population. 60% of them speak Afrikaans, the rest speak English, very few of them would speak an African language. So you have a distinction here, a cultural distinction. Although apartheid has identified colors with blacks in terms of discriminatory legislation, except the question about the caste system, there is a hierarchy. There is a hierarchy. Discrimination is worse here, and it gets increasingly less as you come down. The Asian community, which I haven't spoken about at all, a lot of Indians from India came in 1860, particularly to Natal. So you had another influx of Muslims and a large influx of Hindus. It's not a vast community, but it's 750,000, probably a million people today. Chinese came in 1904. And then the white communities, Afrikaans and English, making up, now it's near 4.5 million, maybe even edging towards 5 million. But the Afrikaner white community being by far in the majority, okay, by almost 1 million. And most of those are Dutch Reform. And that's where the power resides, okay? Although economically, a great deal of the power resides here as well. I should add that in recent times, there have been many more European immigrants in South Africa, ethnic groups from the Mediterranean countries, Italy, Greece, Portugal. Many have come in from other countries in Africa as a result of troubles there, one sort or another. So that you have a very cosmopolitan kind of white community now in the major urban areas. I understand that immigration from Britain last year was 30,000 people. Now, that's not a large figure when you compare to the United States.
But for a relatively small country, 30,000 people coming into South Africa at this point in history is an interesting phenomenon. Unfortunately, most of the more recent immigrants of European background tend to be more racist than the South Africans who are already there. So it doesn't help the problem that one is struggling with. In fact, it makes it more difficult in many ways. It's going to take a while before they become integrated into the life of the country in such a way, hopefully, that they see reality in other terms. But of course, part of the reason for coming to South Africa is not, well, the reason isn't altruistic. The reason is to find employment, or because they are attracted to the kind of image that South Africa has of separation. Because if you live in Nottingham or Birmingham today, you may not have a great deal of kindness towards people of other cultures and races. Well now, let me... does that answer all the questions that you were raising and others were raising? Yeah.
Are the Cape colored people the people who arrived to work on the plantations?
Originally.
Can you tell the colored people from the Africa?
Oh yeah, sure. Yes, sure. I don't like indulging in this exercise because I think it's somewhat sort of invidious and other things, but the Cape colored people are very much like black Americans. Okay. But there are all kinds of gradations, just as those of Norwegian extraction look a little different to German extraction and so on. So, I don't want to get into all that kind of thing.
Were the Asians that were employed as slaves, not employed?
The Asians were brought into... the Asians, the Chinese particularly, were brought into work on the mines, but didn't like that, so became involved in restaurants and laundry.
Is it true that Asians have a lot of the economic power or have traditionally?
Oh, Chinese and Japanese, they there's far less discrimination against those communities, and they kind of like to retain their identity anyway. Mm-hmm. So they sort of relish the structures of the country which give them an identity. Yeah.
Well, then the slaves that were brought to the United States, where did they come from?
They came from West Africa, Central Africa.
Well, not this part at all.
No slaves came from South Africa to North America.
What do you think of Mishner's book about?
The Covenant?
Yeah.
Yeah, as I mentioned yesterday, I think that's a fairly good treatment. Yeah. Okay, well, after a long struggle between the period 1910 and the Second World War, one finds the Afrikaner people struggling to gain power in South Africa. The country was dominated by British interests, economically, culturally, and so on. There was even an attempt by one of the British governors, Lord Milner, to make English the only language in South Africa. Now, that was the quickest way to actually alienate people. And quite frankly, although I come of British extraction, I think the British were totally insensitive to the feelings of the Afrikaner. And a great deal of Afrikaner nationalism wouldn't have been like it is today if it hadn't been for that kind of British imperialistic spirit. They wanted to dominate and control and plant a culture on people who didn't want it, especially after a war where you had just defeated them. So Afrikaner nationalism, which was already there, of course, before the Boer War, became a very potent force afterwards. And gradually, it gained more and more power. Until by the 1930s, virtually all the Afrikaners identified with Afrikaner nationalism. There were some exceptions, like General Smuts, who was one of the founders of the United Nations and so on. But most of the Afrikaners identified with the National Party and its new program of apartheid, which was we must not allow the British to import into South Africa this kind of mixing of everything into a kind of a melting pot culture. We've got to retain our identity, our separateness. And that means that other people have to be kept separate from us. And that means that we must have a policy of separateness. You can't just allow this to happen by chance. In a country where you are overwhelmed numerically by black people, you've actually got to have a policy that keeps you separate. Because you're a minority. So it was a minority group struggling to retain its identity and at the same time to achieve power. And of course, using the philosophy of apartheid, it had a very potent ideological weapon. Because this would have meant, this meant for the Afrikaner, retaining culture, language, identity, achieving power, and not being overwhelmed by other groups, whether they be British or black. Well, after the Second World War, when Afrikaner nationalist feeling was running very high in South Africa, Michener deals with that and many others, the Afrikaner National Party came to power in 1948. Led by Dr. Malan, who was formerly a Dutch Reform Minister. They came to power on the apartheid ticket. And I well remember the election. I was in junior school at the time, and the immediate impact that this had on the street in which I was living. Because within 2 years, that street which had up to that point been integrated, although the black people lived down that end and the white people down that end, there was a sort of shady end in between, all of a sudden, within 2 or 3 years, the black people, the coloured we're talking about here, had to move out. And coloured kids left our school and the buses became segregated. So I can remember something of what it was like before. But since 1948, we've lived for now more than 30 years under a policy that has attempted to separate people. I will point out how at many points it has not worked. It's a policy that can't work, but it can have a jolly good try at working. And in the process, create a great deal of bitterness and suffering, which I will be talking about. But let me conclude by just putting on the board a map of South Africa as presently envisaged by the South African authorities, because what they're trying to do now, and this comes to your question, is in fact to balkanize South Africa, so that you not only have separate development, but you actually create within South Africa different nations with their own land. So that just as you have Lesotho and Swaziland, so there will be Transkei. Well, as far as South Africa is concerned, that is now an independent country. Siskai is an independent country. Maputo, Tswana, Venda, and so on. And this is what the country looks like now politically. Okay, the Union, which became a republic in 1961, the Union of South Africa, is now being broken into different national states. Transkei, Siskai, KwaZulu, some small ones here with names that I won't even try to pronounce for you, Venda, Maputo, Tswana. And the idea is that eventually these territories will be consolidated. At the moment they look like islands, except that there's land between them. In fact, if you travel from Botswana to Johannesburg, you go through Maputo, Tswana three times. quite an experience. Your passport sort of gets quite full. but that indicates, you see, you've got border posts and all the rest, and you've got homeland governments, prime ministers, cabinets, a whole lot in each of these different states. Now, when we talk about separate development, this is what the National Party envisages. The separation of South Africa into different states based on culture and tribal background, with the exception of the coloured and the Indian, or the Asian, because they don't have a homeland. Their homeland is India or China or Malaya. So the policy of the government is to try and incorporate the coloured people and the Asian people into the white community. And that's what has been talked about at the moment in South Africa. That's what the new constitutional proposals are about. The integrating of coloureds and Indians into the white community. Okay? And when you hear about reform in South Africa, that's basically what the thing is all about. Yeah?
At that point then, they would have one passport from South Africa.
Yeah, well, the coloureds have always had a South African passport, and the Indians too, as have all blacks. But now blacks would have a trans-Khai passport, not a South African passport. And the problem is that no government recognizes trans-Khai outside of South Africa. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a trans-Khai passport, there's only one place you can travel to. Well, there are quite a few, actually. You can go to South Africa, or to Ciscar, or to Botswana, or to Zambia. Well, you can get travel documents. That's not impossible. But it's problematic. Yes?
All right. In this land division, who lives in the land where the diamonds are and the gold is?
Well...
Where the blacks live, then?
No, see, most of the gold, is on the Witwatersrand, which is sort of a very industrialized urban area.
And whites live there.
Whites and blacks live there. Yeah. I mean, Soweto is part of the. Oh yeah, you have separate townships and so on. But blacks don't have political rights there.
They don't also don't have industrial rights there.
No. The only place where blacks have control of mining is in Maputo-Tswana, because there are fairly rich mineral resources in Maputo-Tswana.
Now, does the whites govern and control that at all, or not?
Well, theoretically, no.
But in practice? Mm.
Yeah, like America controls mines in Latin America. Mm.
So they're doing in South Africa what the white men do in this country. They're putting, like we put the Indians on Indian reservations, that was the least productive.
Yeah, this is not entirely parallel, because sometimes it's not necessarily an unproductive country. But it's similar. It's very similar.
Do any of the blacks own mines and...
Well, in Maputo-Tswana, as I said.
So that they govern what is...
Yeah, well, the government legislation is that all institutions in the black homelands must be governed by blacks. And therefore, a mining house in Maputo-Tswana would need to have at least, I think, this is the at least 1% black executives. No, not executives, board members, something of that sort. Yeah.
If and when the coloreds are... the reforms go through, will they have all full privileges, voting and...
Envisaged constitution is a tricameral parliament, as it is called. Three houses based upon race. They each have full authority in terms of their own communities and a shared responsibility for national policy with veto rights. But because... the houses are based upon numerical strength, the white parliament will always be numerically stronger than the coloured and the Indian, even when those two are put together. So the only way that that thing could function in terms of opening up the situation would be if some of the white members of parliament had to vote with the coloured and Indians on certain issues. But the constitutional proposals are designed in such a way that it really entrenches white power, although it allows some within the black community to have some kind of rights. It leads to some desegregation in some areas, like schooling and restaurants and things of that sort. But in terms of real political power, it doesn't share it with the black community. And that's where the real political fight is at the moment.
When you say black community, you're talking about color.
I'm talking about the total black community. Those coloured and Indian leaders who have voted in favour of going along with the new constitutional proposals, and blacks are very divided on this issue, believe that this is a way of opening up the whole thing. But others, including myself, don't believe that, although that is a possibility.
By that you mean there may be a constitutional changes that come?
It may be, as many Afrikaners on the right believe, this is the thin edge of the wedge for full black rights. And therefore the Afrikaner National Party has been divided in recent years, so that you have a right wing that has broken away from the National Party, because they believe the National Party is becoming liberal. So when you're talking South Africa about liberal and conservative and so on, it just means something very different to what you might mean by that.
a liberal in South Africa regarded from the perspective of an Afrikaner.